Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 10th of October 1923, a romantic Belgian, an infallible Italian, overpopulation, and it's not all one-way traffic in Birmingham. But first, the headlines. There have been clashes in Dusseldorf between Rhineland separatists and the police. The French estimate that there have been some 300 casualties, which sounds a lot. There's also been a communist uprising in Küstrin, near Berlin, which has been put down. Well, according to the Times, that is. In reality, it was a nationalist uprising. There would appear to have been a real, although one is a bit hesitant to declare it as such, communist uprising in Bulgaria, which has also been put down. In Italy, there is some sort of split in the fascist party. This has led to the resignation of the secretariat. Mussolini, the Duce, then announced that the executive committee had resigned, which it hadn't, but then did, because in a dictatorship, reality is no match for a dictator with a misconception. Technology is a wonderful thing, but it's not without its downsides. This is from Tuesday, the 2nd of October. Mr. John Henry Gregory, the son of Dr. H. L. Gregory of Highgate, was killed on Sunday while attempting to fix a wireless aerial. Mr. Gregory, who was 19 years of age, had climbed a tree in order to fix the aerial when he lost his hold and fell to the ground, breaking his neck. He was an undergraduate at Cambridge and had just won an exhibition. An exhibition was, and is, an award for doing well in Oxbridge entrance exams. It was worth quite a lot of money in those days. In vaguely related news, the Postmaster General has announced that in response to public pressure, he will issue wireless licences for self-built wirelesses, with the proviso that they must use British-made components. Oh, and the licences in question will cost half as much again as ordinary ones. So why the obsession with components being British-made, I hear you ask? Surely this is the age of free trade. Well, it is, but the pressure for protectionism has been growing for decades. Even so, a more likely explanation is that the military have determined that radios will be vital in any future war, and it is vital to have a thriving domestic industry. When they talk about British-made components, I suspect what they mean is not German-made components. This is from Tuesday the 2nd. The death of Count Maticich, which has occurred in a hotel in an obscure corner of Paris, recalls a romantic episode which scandalised the royal houses of Europe before the war. In the spring of 1895, Count Maticich, then a young officer in the Austrian Imperial Hussars, stopped a pair of runaway horses on the Prater in Vienna, and by his gallantry saved the lives of two frightened ladies in the open carriage. One of them was Princess Louise of Belgium, daughter of King Leopold II, and the wife of her cousin, Prince Philip of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. 2 years later, Count Maticich eloped with the princess. Count Maticich was immediately arrested and imprisoned on a charge of forging the signature of Princess Stephanie of Belgium, and Princess Louise was confined in an asylum, first in Vienna, and afterwards at Saxe near Lindenhof. After 4 years of captivity, Count Maticich recovered his liberty, and on a night in September 1904, aided by his friend Count Orsini, he rescued Princess Louise from her guards and again eloped with her. They took refuge in France and henceforth led a precarious existence, practically penniless, wandering from one country to another. I found this in the In Brief section on Monday. The wife of a farmer at Newry has given birth to her 20th child. Large families were not uncommon in those days. In a speech made by the colonial secretary, the Duke of Devonshire, to the Imperial Conference referring to Hong Kong on Thursday, he said this: "A large scheme is under contemplation at present, for an extensive reclamation undertaking, desire to increase the facilities of what is already, from the point of view of tonnage entered and cleared, the biggest port in the world." The number of times I've been told that immediately after the Second World War, Hong Kong was something of a backwater is probably 2. But it seems like a lot, and it's clearly not true. This is from Saturday the 6th. At Bow Street Police Court yesterday, before Mr. Graham Campbell, Harold Woolduck, licensee of the Imperial Hotel Russell Square WC, was summoned for having on various dates in August sold through his servants intoxicating liquor after permitted hours. The magistrate ordered Mr. Woolduck to pay fines and costs totalling £150. The waiters were fined £5 each, the two women were fined £3 each, and the three men similarly summoned were fined £5 each. Hefty fines. A fiver would buy you an ounce of gold. I'm impressed that it's the consumers as well as the suppliers that are getting punished. Obviously, I'd prefer it if it were neither, but seeing as it's the drinking the state is trying to stop, it should be that act that attracts the punishment. On second thoughts, I'm not sure it's the drinking they are trying to stop so much as the shouting and general disruption in the street afterwards. Talking of streets, on Friday the 5th, the Times reported that an experimental one-way system in Birmingham had been deemed a failure and was to be abandoned. Local shopkeepers complained that it was harming trade. A couple of points. First, nowadays in Britain, it is more or less impossible to park outside a shop in a high street. Secondly, central areas are littered with one-way streets, including this part just outside the main station of Birmingham. It raises another question to which I'm sure there is a simple enough explanation. Why wasn't this a problem in the days of the horse and cart? I had long thought that the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 was, as the name suggests, an exclusively French and German affair. None of Britain's business. But there's been a back and forth in the Times this week suggesting that Britain could and should have got involved on the side of France. This is from a Horde Immemore, I kid you not, from Friday. May I recall to Monsieur Villard, the guy who kicked this all off, and to our many sincere friends in France, one principal reason why we did not intervene to check the growing power of Prussia and of Prussia-Germany in 1870. We were duped. We did not know the habits of the Wilhelmstrasse, the location of the German Foreign Office, as we know them now. Bismarck's perfidious mutilation of the Ems telegram and his publication in the Times of July 25th of Benedetti's draft project of 1866 did their business. I have no idea what the Benedetti project was. All I know about the Thames telegram is that it was supposedly quite innocuous before Bismarck got his hands on it, and afterwards a wrong that could only be righted by recourse to arms. Even so, it still seems odd to speak of Britain coming to France's aid in the 1870s. Others are not so reluctant to get violent. This is from Saturday. Extraordinary scenes took place here today in connection with a fight between Mike McTeague and Young Stribling for the light heavyweight championship of the world. McTeague informed the promoters of the fight shortly before it was due to begin that he would be unable to enter the ring owing to an injury to his thumb. He was, however, forced into the ring by a number of men armed with revolvers. The fight therefore took place and was declared at first to be a draw. The ring then was rushed by some of the spectators, and the referee was understood to have altered his decision and declared Stribling to be the winner. What is it about boxing? There are many people who are worried about overpopulation. Much the same was true a century ago. At the British Association conference, one William Beveridge attempted to assuage their fears. Beveridge has become known as the man who founded the welfare state, that I occasionally have to point out began a long time before he ever wrote the Beveridge Report. Anyway, this is what he has to say. This is from Tuesday the 18th of September. Yes, it's from a few weeks ago. It got left out by accident, but I still think it's worth a mention. Many, perhaps most educated people, he said, were troubled by fear that the limits of population probably in Europe and certainly in this country had been reached, and that a reduction in the rate of increase was an urgent necessity. The volume of unemployment in Britain was undoubtedly serious, and almost certainly unparalleled in past history. Those who saw more than a million wage earners, whom our industry for years together was unable to absorb in productive employment, might be excused if they drew the inference that there were too many wage earners in the country, the inference though naturally asserted to be unjustified. Unemployment in Britain could in any case prove nothing about the world as a whole. History showed that it did not prove overpopulation even in Britain. During the last half of the 19th century, the industry of the United Kingdom was finding room for a rapidly increasing number of wage earners with an admittedly rising standard of production and comfort. Anyone who in 1879 had argued that the existing population, then about 34 millions, was all that the United Kingdom could support without lowering its standards, would have been lamentably discredited. 10 years later, he would have found a population nearly 3 millions more, enjoying a real income per head that was a fifth greater, with the unemployment percentage reduced to 2. And 100 years later, we are yet more numerous and yet more prosperous, despite Beveridge's best efforts. Or to put it another way, he was right before he was wrong. The Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, addressed the Imperial Conference of Empire Bigwigs in Downing Street. In his speech, he addressed the many problems facing Britain, from reparations to debt to unemployment. He had this to say. This is from Tuesday the 2nd. The economic condition of Europe makes it essential that we should turn our eyes elsewhere. The resources of our empire are boundless, and the need for rapid development is clamant. There's a word you don't often hear. A clamoring need for rapid development is how we might put it today. I trust that we shall not separate before we have agreed upon the first steps to be taken to create, in a not too distant future, an ample supply of those raw materials on which the trade of the world depends. Population necessarily follows such extension, and that in its turn leads to a general expansion of business, from which alone can come an improvement in the material condition of the people. Interesting to see the way the empire gripped the British imagination in those days. The battlefields of the Western Front were drenched in shells to such an extent during the course of the war that they resembled a moonscape. So what are things like 5 years on? A correspondent has been visiting the old front line. This is from Wednesday. Actually, I think it's from Tuesday. Anyway, this is what he has to say. I have found it easier to trace on the ground the story of the Battle of Waterloo than to follow the course of the fighting on the Somme, although I was there for nearly 6 months. Went over most of the ground again and again, studied it on the maps often scores of times a day. This is not because the battleground of Waterloo is a tiny spot compared to the Somme, because I found it just as difficult to trace out one corner of a battlefield in Flanders, personally familiar to me, and not as big as Waterloo. It would appear that nature and man have done their work. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.